Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world. With host Jason Brooks.
Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. In the vast forests of Siberia, Russia is conducting its biggest war games since 1981, when the Soviet Union was locked in a Cold War with the U.S. 300,000 soldiers, thousands of aircraft, and 36,000 tanks are involved in the exercise. And in a twist, China is taking part in the games, contributing over 3,000 soldiers and an assortment of combat vehicles and aircraft. Joining The Crisis Next Door to make sense of all of this is Jeffrey Mankoff, Deputy Director and Senior Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Russia and Eurasia Program. He's also the author of Russian Foreign Policy, The Return of Great Power Politics. Jeffrey, thanks for joining us here today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Russia is fairly nebulous about the war games, calling it anything from routine drills to an exercise that will send a message to others about its power. The obvious target of that message would seem to be NATO. How seriously should the coalition take this?
Yeah, I would say more than NATO, it's really the United States, because this is an exercise that's taking place in the Russian Far East. It's far away from NATO territory, but it's being done in conjunction with China, which is a departure for this kind of exercise, at least. And it's a message really to the United States, I think, about the potential for deeper Sino-Russian cooperation if Russia feels that it's being pushed into a corner.
Do you feel that Vladimir Putin doesn't think that the U.S. truly respects Russia's military capabilities?
It's hard to know what anybody truly thinks, but I will say that Putin's public statements have indicated that he wants to at least communicate that message at his annual State of the Nation address earlier this year before the Russian presidential elections. He gave a presentation where he had this multimedia demonstration of all of Russia's fancy new weapon systems, and he very pointedly, after showing off all of these systems, said of the United States, of the West, they didn't listen to us before, well, listen to us now. And there is kind of a subtext of the West not listening to, not taking into consideration Russian views that permeates a lot of Russia's what you might call strategic communications.
It would seem as though the West, and the U.S. in particular, should take stronger note of what Russia is capable of doing. Russia has really changed the dynamics in its relationship with the West over the past decade, whether backing separatists in a short war with Georgia in 2008, and then reclaiming the Crimea in 2014, while also backing separatists in the Ukraine, with that fight continuing to slog on, and sending troops and aircraft to Syria in order to prop up Bashar al-Assad. Have those engagements altered the calculus with which the U.S. and NATO considers the Russian threat?
I think so, yeah. The general assumption governing relations with Russia since the end of the Cold War has been that Russia and the U.S., Russia and NATO were no longer adversaries, that they were moving towards some kind of post-Cold War, post-historical world that would be based more on cooperation than confrontation. From Russia's perspective, I think the trouble with that vision was always that it was a Western vision, that the way that partnership was going to be constructed was on the basis of what the West wanted, not what Russia wanted. And so you mentioned the conflict in Georgia. I think that was really the first moment where Russia took concrete steps rather than just declarations to communicate the message that it was tired of not being or not having its interests as it saw them taken into consideration, and subsequent activities, including the conflicts in both Ukraine and Syria, seem to reinforce that message, which is that Russia is a great power. It has the ability to act independently. It has the ability to deploy and use military force, regardless of what the United States or others think, and that it's going to act in defense of what it perceives to be its national interests.
NATO has been beefing up its presence in the Baltic states and Poland, long believed to be potential trigger points to any conflict with Russia. In particular, the Baltic states of Estonia and Latvia, which have heavy Russian minority populations, a product of those countries' former membership in the Soviet Union. How much of a threat is Russia to those countries?
You can think of threats as involving both intentions and capabilities. As far as the capabilities go, Russia has very significant capabilities to pose a threat to the Baltic states. On the intention side, of course, one can never be 100% sure about an adversary's intentions, but given the Baltic states' membership in NATO, the presence of allied forces in the territory of those countries, it would be a very significant risk and a very significant escalation for Russia to undertake military activities in those countries. So I think the risk is real, and it's something that military planners in NATO and in the governments of Latvia and Estonia, among others, have to take seriously. But at the same time, I think it's a pretty low probability event, because NATO actually provides a security umbrella for these countries, and I think Russia understands that use of military force against a NATO member would risk getting into a conflict not only with relatively small countries like Estonia and Latvia, but with the NATO alliance as a whole.
Defense analysts say the key to preventing war is credible deterrence. Do you think there is enough deterrence for Russia in those NATO countries?
I would say yes. In the last couple of years, NATO's taken steps to preposition forces in those countries. It's not a large number of forces. We're only talking a little bit over 1,000 troops in each of Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Poland. But those are multinational forces. Those are Americans, they're British, they're Canadian, they're German, and they're under the auspices of NATO, which means that in the event of a conflict, they would be involved in it from the very beginning. And in that sense, they serve as a kind of tripwire, because if you have American or other allied soldiers coming under fire, then politically it's almost impossible for those countries not to react very strongly. And I think Russia understands this.
Now, much of this is based on a rather large-scale conventional attack, but as we saw in the Ukraine and Crimea, as well as in Georgia, Russia has used some alternative methods, whether it's the little green men or using social media. How much of that would factor into this? And could Russia see a possibility to use those kinds of asymmetrical means to achieve some sort of goal in altering borders or having greater influence on those countries?
I think that's a much more visible, worrying possibility for those countries, because there's no clear red line around the use of cyber information, even sort of special operations activities that fall below the threshold of armed conflict. And because there's not a clear red line around those activities, I think the ability to credibly communicate deterrence the way that you can with conventional military actions is much more difficult. And we've already seen some of these kind of activities take place vis-a-vis those countries that you mentioned on the eastern flank of NATO. Perhaps the most well-known is in 2007, when the Estonian government was planning to move a monument to Soviet soldiers who had been in the country during the Second World War. And the Russian government, basically charged the Estonians with trying to equate the Soviet presence and the Nazi presence, and with historical revisionism and disrespect of the sacrifice of Soviet soldiers. And they launched a large-scale cyber attack that took down a lot of Estonian computers and servers and the like. You've seen similar kinds of activities deployed in the context of Russia's wars in Georgia, Ukraine, and elsewhere. And again, because if we're not talking about things that cause physical damage or lead to people being killed, it's not clear that those activities would inevitably lead to an armed response or to a response of the level that would be capable of deterring those actions in the first place. So I think those are very real contingencies and things that both the governments in places like Tallinn and Warsaw and Riga, Vilnius, need to take seriously, but also in the context of the alliance, you know, figuring out how do you build a credible deterrence posture around activities that fall short of the threshold for armed conflict.
Do you think that the U.S. and those NATO members are making any progress in figuring out how to deal with those cybersecurity issues and to deal with the lack of the red line that could cause these conflicts?
I think some progress has been made. It's slow because we're talking about tools that are relatively new and where international norms haven't really coalesced yet. But during the most recent NATO summits, this has been very much a topic of conversation. There's been a real emphasis on resilience, so figuring out how to harden systems to make them more resistant to sabotage or to cyber penetration, and also societal resilience, teaching people to be more media literate, to be less trustful of things of things that may prove to be disinformation. So on that side of things, there has been some progress that's been made, but at the same time, I think we still see these kind of activities being undertaken, including, should add, in the United States, and having an effect, in part because the responses that have been articulated so far have not been entirely adequate.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking about Russia's massive military war games. And we're talking to Jeffrey Mankoff, Deputy Director and Senior Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Russia and Eurasia Program. Jeffrey, since the fall of the Soviet Union, NATO has aggressively added new members from Russia's periphery, much to Moscow's consternation. Does Moscow truly fear potential NATO aggression on its borders, or is this more about maintaining neighborhood influence?
It's a little of both, I would say. NATO has been clear that it has no offensive intentions vis-a-vis Russia, and has taken steps like the NATO-Russia Pact, or the NATO-Russia, I guess, yeah, it was... Well, there was the NATO-Russia Founding Act, I guess, which was signed in the late 1990s, and NATO committed to not stationing what they called substantial combat forces in new member states along Russia's borders, and that was designed to provide reassurance to the Russians that, you know, there wouldn't be a military capability capable of launching offensive operations against Russia. The Russian concern is still there and stems from a couple of places. One is the precedent. So even if NATO today says that it has no intention of stationing substantial combat forces in these countries, the Russian concern is that circumstances could change, and certainly circumstances have changed since the annexation of Crimea and the conflict in Ukraine. And NATO could change its mind. And now that these countries are members, it would be easier for a decision to be taken to deploy not only the relatively small rotational forces that are there now, but to deploy more larger units as well. And the second piece of it, I think, has to do with the issue that you raised about maintaining influence, because NATO is a military alliance, but it's not just a military alliance. It's a military alliance that's, in principle at least, based on a set of ideas that Russia, by and large, doesn't share. And so countries that commit to being members of the NATO alliance, like the European Union, also commit to implementing institutions and policies that coincide with these values. And in doing that, they become less amenable to Russian pressure, Russian suasion, Russian efforts to influence the way that they act. And, you know, you've seen this with a number of countries in Central and Eastern Europe, and to a lesser degree in the former Soviet Union, where NATO membership was one step that was followed by membership in the European Union. And there's been a sort of gradual process of changing the what you might call the operating system of their governments, so that there's less corruption, there's less oligarchy, there's more transparency, and it's harder for Russia to pull on the levers that it has previously been able to pull on to influence those countries. And over the last few years, there's been a Russian response, which has been to try and actively promote you know, this kind of murky political culture and to undermine rule of law institutions in a number of these countries. It's not a traditional military conflict, but it's a conflict over ideas and institutions and elites that Russia has had quite a bit of success in waging.
The key for NATO has always been that if one country is attacked, the rest of the NATO members will come to its aid. Do you think that that resolve is just as strong within NATO today as it was, say, during the Cold War?
Hopefully we don't have to find out. During the Cold War, there were always questions. There were always questions whether the United States was going to risk a nuclear attack on New York in order to save Berlin, let's say. And fortunately, we didn't have to answer that question. But the general proposition that the United States would be willing to do that was believed to the extent that at least after 1948, the Soviet Union didn't really try to test it. Today, it's hard to say. You have more in the United States right now than anywhere else. You have a political leadership that's openly questioning the value of NATO. And you know, I think there's still a pretty broad and deep support for NATO within the U.S. political establishment, but it's perhaps more questionable now than it's been in some time. And beyond that, there's a generational issue, which is that people who don't remember the Cold War, people who don't recall why the United States has this large military presence in Europe, are less invested in the maintenance of that military presence or the maintenance of the transatlantic relationship. You know, not because they're pro-Russian necessarily, but because I think they see they don't see the value necessarily. They don't understand what it is that those American troops and the American money that, that pays to keep them there are accomplishing. And that's a challenge. I think it's something that the American political leadership and the political establishment more generally has to do a better job of making the case for why that continued commitment to the transatlantic relationship remains important.
Putin must love the antipathy shown right now by the current White House towards NATO. It's got to be something that he wants to take advantage of.
Yeah, no doubt. Russian and before that Soviet strategy always emphasized trying to play on fissures between the United States and its European allies to stoke uncertainty in Europe about the degree of the U.S. commitment and to undermine support for that commitment in the United States. And in that regard, there's more historical memory about this issue in Russia than there probably is in the United States. But you're right, there's an administration now that, for whatever variety of reasons, is taking positions that I think are very, at least on this particular issue, are very amenable to Russian views.
Russia and China have never been that chummy, having fought some border skirmishes in the past. How important is China's participation in this exercise, and how does that impact China's relationship with the U.S.?
I think China's participation is it's significant, but I wouldn't overstate it. Yes, the Sino-Russian relationship has been complicated. Past Russian exercises in the Far East have, for all intents and purposes, been designed to test a response to a Chinese attack, even if they've tried to sort of downplay that as the base scenario. Having Chinese troops participating this time, of course, is a signal to Beijing that Moscow is not focusing on fighting Chinese troops the way that it may have been in previous iterations of this exercise. It's also a signal to the West, and particularly the United States, that even though the Sino-Russian relationship may still be complicated, and even though China may be the senior partner in that relationship, Russia is willing to go more down the path of a Sino-Russian say entente rather than alliance, but to move in that direction. If the U.S.-Russia relationship remains as bad as it is or gets worse.
Jeffrey, your renowned book on Russia, The Return of Great Power Politics, is nearly a decade old. You maintained at the time that a return to the Cold War standoff between Russia and the West was unlikely. How much has your opinion changed since then?
I think we're in something that has at least uncomfortable echoes of the Cold War. It's not the same. It doesn't have the same global impact, and I don't think the ideological dimension is as pronounced as it was during the Cold War. But we're in, we're definitely in a standoff, and I think it grows out of the difficulty that collectively we've had figuring out where Russia fits in the security order that was constructed at the end of the Cold War. We wanted Russia involved in that order, but we didn't want to adapt the order to Russia. We wanted Russia to adapt to the order, and that was a proposition that never had a lot of support in Russia, and especially in the last decade or so, Putin has made clear that that's not a bargain that he's willing to accept.
Well, they say history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme, and it does seem like there is a bit of rhyming going on there. Jeffrey, thank you very much for joining us today on The Crisis Next Door. We've been joined by Jeffrey Mankoff, Deputy Director and Senior Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies Russia and Eurasia Program. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.